you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Greetings, citizens of Earth and all beings, both extraterrestrial and interdimensional. My name is Danny Roth, and this is Who Won the Week, Sci-Fi Wire's podcast dedicated to the top stories from the week in geek. I am joined this week by my co-host, the blurred girl, Kara Mahorn, Adam Swiderski, nowhere to be found. Where did he go? He's a giant man. How did he vanish? I don't know. It's a mystery. But in his place, we do have Chico Leo, who is one of the hosts of the Scream Squad podcast and is going to be in a new podcast. Are you hosting this, Sword and Scandal?
Yes, I'm hosting Sword and Scandal. It's a new podcast coming out about epic film. Well, it's using epic film as a jumping off point, talking about like historical issues of representation in historical TV movies and a little bit TV shows, but mostly movies. And I think it's sort of an elegy to movies are sort of really, I think, a 20th century art form and are sort of, you know, it's been the baton has been passed to TV and then I think the baton will be passed to video games.
Yeah, I agree.
So like the Assassin's Creed video games, you know,
Creed.
It's like I think more people are getting history from there than school or old movies.
Which is
so weird
because
it's
both the past and the future.
Right, right.
So they better get both correct 100%. What's it? Have you recorded any episodes already?
No. I'll be recording actually the first few episodes this month, and I'm hoping to actually release the first episode before the end of September.
Can you tell me what the first episode's going to be about? Like what topics you're covering?
Oh, we're going chronologically, so we're starting at the beginning. The first episode we'll be talking about Quest for Fire and the Dawn of Man sequence from 2001.
Starting with
Kiana Skotsky. You know?
Yeah, no, we're starting with prehistoric caveman movies, and then moving into ancient Egypt, Bible movies. It's going to be. I mean, it could go on for 50 years.
I was going to say Ben Hur did.
Yeah,
wow, got him.
Yeah,
that's pretty.
So,
good.
So yeah, that's. Oh yeah, Ben Hur won't be for like till like the 20th or 30th episode.
You should start watching it now,
right.
So you can get there.
Yeah, it's hard. It's not an easy thing to do when you do chronological. My wife and her friend are doing a podcast where they're doing every apocalyptic novel from like the very first one that came out forward. And so like it starts off pretty quick. Like you get through like the 19th century real fast, but like 20th century, like once you hit like 1940s through 60s, it's like the 1960s, there's like 10,000 books on that topic. And each decade, it's infinitely more. So
I'm going to have to actually start really, and then certainly when you get to, the modern times of World War II and the Civil War, there's so many movies and I'm not planning on spending like 10 episodes on, one period. So, but
you know what we should do, though? We should do like, what's that TV show like Drunk History? I want to come on the show. So, can we drink and do this?
Oh,
can we
absolutely.
Drink and talk about Ben Hur?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, no. Unfortunately, I think it's a little early here. Most podcasts I've been on, they actually provide a little liquid that's not water. Lubricate the guests.
What time does your podcast shoot?
It's only 10:30 a.m. right now, but yeah. I will say I have been up since 4 a.m. So, I don't know. Have I been awake long enough?
Wow.
It feels like it.
Yeah.
It's like lunchtime.
It definitely does.
It's lunchtime in your world.
It's, yeah.
You could be having sake about now in Japan.
It's bedtime in my world right now. Anyway, we're in this Who Won the Week podcast. Let's talk about the week, I think. How about that? Is that cool?
That is, Adam's not here to tell you no. So
okay,
you know
all right.
Saying?
I mean, yeah, it's true.
This week.
The thing is,
do what you want. This is a safe space. Danny.
Adam is already listening, being like, I can't believe how far off the rails this has gotten. So I will corral things. I'll be a professional. I guess. We do a thing at the top of the program where we talk about what we're personally geeking out about. Adam's not here to give approval, so I'm gonna. I don't know if you heard me give myself a pat on the back, but we're gonna do it. Karma, what is winning your week?
I also haven't had much sleep because I stayed up to play Spider-Man at midnight. I was at, you know, Angelique, who's been here before as a guest, she had downloaded it, and I just conveniently was like, I'm coming over at 11. And so it's really a lot of fun. If I actually have like the first 4 minutes of gameplay or movie and gameplay up on my IGTV because I was like, this is amazing. The interesting thing about it is, it is very, very true to New York. Like when they talked about the open world and how true it was. It's, remember watching Spider-Man Homecoming when you were like, oh, this is very much like New York. This is very cool. I mean, until he got out of the subway in Queens and we're like, that's not Queens. But everything else looked very, very like Midtown and everything. And how he would go in and out of the bodegas and things like that. It's very much like that. Before we found the maps and stuff, it was really funny, too, because one of the first things you got to do was stop, like, a fight that's happening in Times Square, and you start, like, downtown, and it was so funny because we couldn't find the map, but because we were from New York, we were like, no, we're in Union Square. You got to go north. We know where we are. And I was like, well, there's got to be a map for the people that live in, I don't know, Kansas that don't know anything about New York. There's a lot of people in this story. Peter seems to be, like, 8 years older than his comic book counterpart, so it's sort of a coming of age. There is a Miles Morales who's like 15, but he's not. I don't think he's going to become any kind of Spider-Man in this. It's just he just has a friend. Yes, I know he's got an Afro-Latino friend named Miles Morales that is hanging out with him. I've only seen him in two movies so far, so I don't know his full story. The whole Sinister Six is there: Electro, Rhino, Doc Ock, Scorpion, and then, of course, Silver Sable with her Sable International.
I was going to say, this just sounds like a ripoff of the Sega CD game Spider-Man versus Kingpin. But once you bring in Silver Sable, bets are off, I guess.
Yeah, and then the storyline is a little bit that they're like the hired heroes and Spider-Man is like in the way, but you could tell that there's something going on. Underhanded. And then, of course, the Sinister Six is being run by Mr. Negative, who, it's so funny that Adam isn't here because I was going to tease him about Mr. Negative. You don't know this, but my nickname Adam is Mr.
Negative.
Yeah,
the editor-in-chief. You know, everybody's boss is just, she just like blithely calls him Mr. Negative.
But he's like, I'm not, always. Anyway, so those of you who heard stuff about the backpacks, that basically they are, you were right. Actually, they are Easter eggs. They are Easter eggs that Spidey's left himself backpacks all over the city. They're like webbed to different things. If you find them, you pick them up. They usually have tools and stuff in them. You can play the game without the Easter eggs, but I guess it's kind of like playing a Star Wars game without the loot, paying for the loot boxes. It just takes you longer.
Okay. I was going to say, is it kind of like...
It's not mandatory, but it's you'll need some things that you don't have, basically.
Okay. So it's almost a little bit like the Riddler stuff in like the Batman Arkham.
Or like treasure chests that where you need stuff in the, what was it, God of War, most recent one.
But it's not like vital. Like if you don't get this, you die.
Right.
The other interesting thing about it is, which anybody out there that has any type of... what is it? Like the thing when you're
vertigo.
Scared. Vertigo. Yeah. You need to sit on the floor and play this game if you have vertigo. Because basically, in order to get some real height, you have to swing. You have to jump off a building and basically almost hit the ground before you shoot a web to get some real distance. Right. I mean, I guess it's math, you know, arcs, geometry, right, things like that, velocity. But still, it's very.
Torque.
Yeah. See, I don't even. That is a visual that I didn't need this early in the morning. So the
Oh, no, I said torque, not twerk.
I thought you said twerk.
Oh, no, I said torque. That was an actual, you know.
Now everybody has a visual.
Come on, man.
You guys didn't think of the Ice Cube motorcycle movie Torque from about 10, 12 years ago when he said that? That's what I did. That was my...
No, we all definitely did that. That's it.
I'm trying to think.
You're such an everyman.
Oh, that's the other thing that's really cool. Similar to This Is Us? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to that game, you can pick up.
The Last of Us.
I thought you were talking about a video game
where you just cry.
You cry for 2 hours.
Yeah,
no,
there's a lot of pretty men, and you
I
weep.
Always do that. No, Last of Us, you don't burst into tears. Last of Us,
you also cry in that one.
You do, but you can pick up random objects, and they're not lit up. It's not like they're like, hey, over here, you can use me. You can just literally turn around, and like, oh, there's a tire, I'll throw it. like I in one demo I saw somebody picked up a soda machine. Spidey picks up a soda machine and like hurls it at somebody. So there's all these things that you can pick up and throw, which is really kind of fun. And yes, the graphics are absolutely amazing. You are not going to finish this game quick. I know people. There were people I saw. That were like,
yeah, the review said you finish it in like 2.5 hours or something.
No, what that? But the thing is, they're all choices. So there's. I mean, it's not like, it's not like you have to make a choice and get. You know, like Assassin's Creed. It's not like that kind of RPG thing.
Right.
If somebody played that game and got through it in 2 hours, it's because they work for the actual company.
Do any of the side missions or any of the.
Or they work for Insomniac Games.
Right.
Like literally, there's no. I don't understand how it took us 2 hours to figure out how to get Uptown. But anyway, but it was the cutscenes are really good. The cutscenes are actually extremely good. Like some of the cutscenes, I'm like, can this be a movie?
Yeah,
can
they've
I
been getting
this?
Better, I think, in general, in like the A-list video games the last few years, really remarkably, the cutscenes.
The other thing that's also interesting, and I only heard this because I actually was watching some of the Marvel preview stuff, is that even the music, they recorded like a record number of tracks so that based on the decisions you make and where you go, the music will change. So the music will not be, even if you play the game like, you know, 30 times or something, you'll never hear the same piece of music in this if you know on the same street or whatever. So it's all very interesting. And then the other thing that's really cool is that the people interact with you, and the city is sort of 50-50 pro Spidey against Spidey. So you'll land and somebody will be like high five, and then you'll land and somebody will be like idiot, you know. It's just, it's really interesting. And then if you like break somebody's window or whatever, it's like, are you gonna pay for that, you know? So
do they play any music by Mr. Big?
I did not hear it. Oh, but the funniest
thing... Again, there's
a
Mr. Big song in the Sega CD game, Spider-Man vs. Kingpin.
But they might have. I'm not there yet.
So if that song is not in this game, I'm not interested.
But you know what is in the game, which is really, really cool, and I did tweet this out like probably 1 a.m, is that on Fifth Avenue, where Trump Tower is in real life here in New York City, they've made it Fisk Tower.
Oh,
using
nice.
Using the same font,
right.
The same gold lettering. I was like, oh, I see what you did there. And there's a big fight that actually happens inside Fisk Tower. It's
but
very
is
cool.
The Kingpin is in it?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Wow.
Absolutely. And who else is in it? Black Cat? Yeah, Black,
yeah,
Cat,
Black
is in
Cat
it.
Is in it.
J. Jonah Jameson does
but there,
a lot
you don't
of
really
the
get
narration.
A lot. So, like, so this is like one of those. This is like the one thing I'll definitely ding this game for is that, like, so Black Cat I know is in the game, yeah. But unless you bought like the one with all the DLC that's coming out later, you're not getting the full Black Cat story. This is one of those games where like you got part of the game.
If you paid like
the rest
90
of the game comes
bucks.
Later, right. If you paid the extra money for
yeah.
it.
I know. I saw like comic skaters online complaining because the Black Cat's costume is less scanty than in the comics.
Oh no!
Yeah,
yeah.
I can't believe it.
Because Comics Gate doesn't like something with
right.
a woman in it.
Yeah, well, or yeah, because feminists designed the game. That's what they say.
Okay.
So my question is, you don't think if they do several sequels to the game, which they probably will, that Miles Morales will be like saying like it'll probably be like number 4 or something like that, that he'll take over the mantle.
I think they will, but I also think they're waiting for the animated the Spider-Verse to drop over Christmas, and I think we're gonna see all of the spider people.
Oh yeah. Well, I guess you'll see how it plays. Like, so if that movie is successful, which I believe that it will be,
yes,
yeah.
Then I think that'll probably have an impact on the trajectory of the games going forward for sure.
But you can only stay in New York. There's no time travel. Like, it looks like the animated movie has a bit of time jumping in it. There's none
when
of that.
Is there gonna be a game about Kane? Where's the Kane game?
Wait, are we talking about Kane from Cain and Abel or Kane?
No, see, you went too far back.
Yeah, no.
Biblical, right.
Yes,
no.
Exactly.
No, I meant
Kane,
I mean,
from
like,
Kung Fu?
Is he the worst of the Peter Parker clones?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think he might be.
Yeah,
I think he might be. I just was trying to go as far to the bottom of the
I
barrel.
I would like to see. Oh, but you do have. I actually think Kane's outfit is in it because there's a bunch of outfits you can change. Punk Spidey is in this. I will be playing as Punk Spidey.
With the original like Steve Ditko
I couldn't
Spider-Man
find it
outfit?
But they say it's in there.
Cool.
Because
I was going to say, like, that actually bothered me from the trailers. Like, I was like, I want to see him in.
They've got to have
know.
The Ben Reilly outfit.
Yeah.
Yes,
that's
they do.
Yeah.
And then,
that Ben
then,
Reilly one is so good.
You don't get all of the things unless you, like you said, pay the money for the deluxe. Then you get every single iteration of the actual.
This is a gaming problem, though, more than like I'm not trying to come for like this is the first game to ever do this.
Oh no,
like,
no, it's definitely. I mean, look, they got to make money, and you know, they've figured out many ways to get you from different angles.
Like next week, Tomb Raider comes out, and if you want to play it 2 days early. You've got to pay extra money, and then you get the special 2 days early edition. Like
the list of different versions of the new Red Dead game that's coming out is like literally like 14 different like versions that you can get like
at
different
of
different price points, you know, between like $60 and $150. And
anyway, this is this is running the risk of being like three old people yelling at one cloud.
Get off my lawn. Yeah.
So what are you geeking out about, Chico?
So I'm geeking out actually, and I'm a little surprised about it. The Mayans premiered this week, which was a spinoff of Sons of Anarchy.
And I didn't get a chance to see it yet, and I'm bummed.
So I almost didn't watch it. I put Sons of Anarchy very firmly on shows that I thought the first season had a lot of potential that I watched for several seasons, and it just got worse and worse and worse. And so it's sort of like Downton Abbey and Entourage, like these shows that I actually watched like four or five seasons of that I really regret and I wish I had my time back. So I thought
I still watch Supernatural, so
okay,
I don't know what
like,
you mean.
Yeah, I was going to say what the 14th season
I've
is about.
I've been watching since day one.
Yeah, wow, yeah. So
something wrong.
I thought Sons of Anarchy was a real hot mess. I'm a huge proponent of like FX's programming. I happen to think that they've been consistently the best network. And so it was really because of FX that I was like, all right, I know Sons of Anarchy is super popular. I thought it was just a total mess. You know, the Mayans had a really, really, really strong pilot. And it's definitely set in that universe. There are a couple of cameos in the pilot if you're a Sons of Anarchy viewer or fan.
Are they going to have flashbacks of other characters that may have died?
Yeah, yes. Yes, okay. Indeed. I don't not to give, but yeah. So I was really pleasantly surprised with the Mayans. And
but it takes place now, though.
It definitely takes place now. And the one thing I will say, Sons of Anarchy had Gemma, which was a really, really great, strong female character. The Mayans, they're so far only have two female characters. And like all the male characters are Latinx, and there's two female characters, and one is white and one is an extremely light-skinned Latinx woman. So I thought they could have done more with the representation of women. And I thought that Gemma was one of the strengths of the strength of Sons of Anarchy. So I'd like to see them introduce more female characters going, but it was just the pilot. And I did always like the stuff just in the MC universe that they, you know, set up.
Funny. I liked Sons of Anarchy, but I felt it like kind of went up and down. I felt like it started really strong, was really good. And then it was like, okay, I don't understand what's happening. Wait, what? Henry Rollins, what are you doing? Like all kinds of craziness.
Right.
And then it came up for a bit. And then it just, I felt like the ending was like, huh? Like I had the same feeling that I had after the ending of Lost. Like, what just happened?
The Henry Rollins moment, I feel like, the specific moment that I'm thinking of is actually, I sort of feel like when it really jumped the shark. I was like, this had potential to go one way. And then they go to Ireland and they kill like 20 Irish cops and then they get out of the country. Like, if you think about that, like, it's just not set in any kind of realistic world.
That was the part that confused me. I'm like,
they get out of jail and they're allowed to carry weapons. Like, there's just like sort of all this stuff. And then I felt like they weren't faithful to the characters at all. It was just very much like, oh, we need someone to do this. Oh, we'll have them do that, even though they would never do that.
Yeah, I got the feeling that because it was Katie Sagal's husband that was the
Kurt
writer.
Sutter. Yeah.
I got the feeling that he, like a Netflix show, when it was supposed to be less episodes, and they made him stretch it out, and you could feel it halfway through.
Well, they literally stretched it out. The episodes were like an hour and a half with commercials. I thought that was,
ridiculous.
I don't know if that could be a programming thing so they could sell them as hour-long shows to, like HBO Kuala Lumpur or something like that.
I have no idea.
Kuala Lumpur.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, real specific.
But Mayans rather, though.
Yeah, so I thought I had a very strong pilot. I really liked the cast. I really liked, there's like a... they introduce like a, I don't want to say a gang. I don't know. They introduce something that's really cool that I hadn't seen that, there's a lot of stuff you see with like cartels and bad guys. I don't know. It sort of had a new take on some stuff. And, Yeah, I was really pleasantly surprised by that. And I don't know if I can say two things. I'm psyched for I've been really down on HBO for a while now, and I'm really psyched that The Deuce is coming back. I think it's one of the few
really
good, like, decent things that's been on the network in the last 5-10 years. Game of Thrones excluded, but
Just walking past the HBO store the other day, and I was like, I don't even know why they call this the HBO store. This is the Game of Thrones store.
Right, exactly. Well, what are they going to
do? It's what they have. It is the one thing they've
got. Get your sharp objects, paraphernalia. Get your, I don't know, like what? Yeah, they've got no shows that they can sell stuff, other than Game of Thrones. Yeah.
Maybe they could sell a robot that cries, and that can be like their Westworld tie-in product.
Right.
As long as the robot has a good butt, we don't care.
Wow, yikes.
What are you geeking out about?
Who, me?
Yeah, you.
Oh, well, I would say I'll take two things. One, it's my anniversary. I've been married for 6 years.
Yeah,
I don't know if you can say that. That's a thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I'm feeling really grateful. 6 years it's the longest I've ever been married. So, and the only time. So
I was going to say.
Yeah, so I'm very happy about that. And then, that's the nice thing. And then, the thing that I'm sure some people will think is kind of mean spirit is. I would say that folks like Neil Gaiman and Scott Snyder and Mr. King, there's a couple other folks, all kind of came out this week.
Bill Sienkiewicz.
Bill Sienkiewicz has really been on for the last couple weeks now.
Yeah, Bill looks like he
kind of came today this week.
He cleared his schedule.
Right, exactly, exactly.
He was like, the kids, all right, that's it.
Yep.
So what we're talking about is what is not actually going to be the death knell for Comicsgate, but kind of feels like they've really lost their relevance in a way. I mean, not that they were super relevant before, but they had gotten some degree of control. There were people paying attention to them, and now I think they seem like a bit of a joke. The thing that really turned the page, though, about them, and if you don't know what Comicsgate is they would tell you that they just want comics to not be political, but what they really are is kind of a white supremacist fueled movement.
Right, they want to make comics great again.
Yeah.
They want to make comics white again.
Right. Yeah,
they question any writer or artist that is a person of color or a woman. And then I know there's some people out there that go, but there's women that are part of Comicsgate. Yes, just like there are women that voted for Trump.
Right. So they brought in, the last goalpost movement was Eve Ewing was coming in to write an Ironheart book. Right. That was the deal. And they were like, oh, this is enough. They keep bringing in these hires that have never worked in comics before. And it's all sizzle, no steak. And Neil Gaiman rolled in and was like, I hadn't really, before I started working for the big two, hadn't really written comics. And then one of the two ringleaders of the movement started to question whether or not Neil Gaiman was lying.
Right, he was like,
or remembered his own career.
Yeah, exactly.
And Neil kept going okay, but you have to know the timeline of when I pitched these things, when those things were written, when things were released. You don't know Mike. Who do you think knows their career better, me or you? It's my career. It's my, Neil Gaiman, I will tell you, that is a man who knows his own situation. That is a man possessed of a very well-earned big ego.
But also, we saw Neil Gaiman very swiftly fight, if you've been into sci-fi pros, he was fighting the sad puppies and the the angry puppies for a minute.
But this sort of him having this argument over his own career sparked a lot of other people coming in saying didn't do anything. I had a novel that bombed and then DC picked me up. You know what I mean? This is a thing that it's not. And as soon as you bring that out, it's there's what goalpost is there left? Where is it? Where can you move it at that point? And then I think right after that, Vox Day snuck in, and Vox Day is an actual alt-right white supremacist. And Comicsgate was that's not us though. And then everyone was
It is.
Well, there was some
really
sort of
is.
There was
if
some
it
sort
walks
of
like a duck and talks like a duck.
Some sort of fight or something that happened between Vox Day and Ethan Van Sciver,
I forget the dude's name who's diversity in comics.
Right.
There was like a whole big thing.
But there
thing.
Was something went down a few days ago that where there was like I feel like there was a rift or something, and people in comics hate took both sides.
Well, the biggest issue, I think the one that you might be thinking of is the one with Jeff Lemire and Bill Sienkiewicz, where they jumped in. They jumped in basically because Billy Tucci referenced the late Darwin Cook.
Oh, right.
That was pretty.
That was
Darwin Cook's wife.
Darwin Cook's wife.
No, this was something that happened.
His widow was like, he would think you guys were right. Idiots.
And he definitely would. Now, two or three days ago, there was some sort of live stream, video thing where they got into it and, you know, were owning each other or owning each other with a P
Do you think, Danny, that this really is the death knell? Or do you just think that,
I don't,
you know,
that's a fine question.
Do
I don't think it'll ever go away.
Do you think that it's just another schoolyard fight, school's over, and they're going to just come back?
Yeah, I don't think it's
next
the
week
death
do it
knell,
again.
But I think the major thing is like big, heavy hitter adults, like the name, the people that you mentioned have come in and commented on it.
I wish they had come in sooner, but the fact of the matter is that, like, yeah, I mean, I had a lot of friends who were doing this fight who don't have, like maybe they have like a decent Twitter following, but they don't have a huge comic book following.
Right.
They don't have like outside of the realm of this one thing. Like, people didn't, I don't know how aware people were of ComicsGate and how. Frankly, it was. I do think it was having a negative influence, and I think that it is now. I think it has lost some control, certainly, that it had. Like, I don't, like, is it going to go away? No. I mean, like, white supremacists have existed for how long? ComicsGate, like, whether it goes by a different name or the same name, will continue in some form. But I do think that, at least in this moment, it was a real, in my mind, victory for the comic book community as a whole.
Sure. And I think that it's, I think Bill Sienkiewicz and Neil Gaiman, like, these are A-plus listers in the, you know, the equivalent of, like, Beyonce or Steven Spielberg in the comic book community.
And a lot of these folks are, like, also,
Bill
like...
Bill Sienkiewicz to Beyonce?
I'm saying just that, like, level of...
I think another aspect of it is, like, I thought this about, like, when Jeff Lemire and Scott Snyder came out. Those are nice guys. Those are quiet, like... get along with anybody guys. When Scott Snyder is mad about a thing, you know something's bad, because like he really, in at least his public facing self, that is not a man that goes out and gets flustered about things. Like if he's gonna be mad about something and say it, you know that like, oh, there might actually be something to be mad about. He doesn't exist in the outrage culture, I don't think. So
no, and I, you know, the one thing I will say is that this points to is that there is still, and this existed way back when, and this existed, I worked at DC in the 90s for 4 years, and there is a much bigger problem finding new writers and new talent. There isn't something set up the way there is for artists, where artists can send in their samples, people look at the samples, and then hire them.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not that the problem is that there's nothing set up. There's writers, but that tool, I think, like Disney's writing program or Marvel's, you know,
Scott has done a thing. Scott Snyder does like bring people on.
Throughout the years, but to sit down and read a spec script takes 20 minutes. To look at samples, art samples,
on Instagram
takes less than 20 seconds.
Yeah.
Like, so
you know immediately.
So yeah, exactly. And so I think a lot of editors don't want to spend that 20 minutes times however many samples. I mean, that I can say actually without a doubt that. And so, you, except when you have someone like Karen, you know, when she went and found, Karen Berger went and found Neil Gaiman and all the British talent in the late 80s and brought them, you know, brought them over.
Right, it takes the effort that
it's a huge effort.
But at the same time, even when she was doing that, comics weren't coming out every 15 minutes.
No.
It was still a slower printing and production
piece. Yeah, I don't know. The comics writers that I know that are not within the big two that are trying, that just want to get stuff out, those are the people that are using like Kickstarter and stuff like that to get it done. And the thing is, like, that's the beauty of that whole side of the market, is that it does exist now. I have a buddy that I couldn't even guess how many Kickstarters that he's run successfully. He knows there's a formula to it. There's a way to make it work. And then you get your books out. And the fact is, like, if you put out something good and you share it around, it gets popularity, then at some point somebody else might take an interest. Like, Image is going to be more interested. Marvel DC is going to be more interested. If you had a book that was already out that you did, like, and there's a nice built-in community of people that are doing that where, like, they'll all support it. Like, it literally, it's like, I've watched this now, like, Kickstarter comic. Okay, I need, like, $10,000 or whatever it is. All right. So here's what you do. You make sure that you've, like, got everything ready to go. Day one, you've got to make, it's like you got to make $1,000 in the first hour, and you got to get at least halfway there by the end of day one. Like,
you don't
that's required.
Have to. You can, in the first 3 days, in the first 72 hours,
if you want a guaranteed success and you have certain, like added goals that you want to make sure you hit, I mean, you don't have to, but, like, if you want to up your chances, if you want to make sure that you almost definitely are going to get there, I think you have to be like, if it's $10,000 you want to get in 30 days or 17 days or however long is that you do it, like, you want to hit somewhere around that halfway mark if you can. And then it just becomes a matter of, like, all right, can we get to this amount by the end of this day? And then knowing exactly when each added incentive you're going to put out is and what you can do to get the people that already gave to give a little more and make sure that you're going to hit your amount. But, like, it's interesting to watch, and that I find is for writers, for comic book writers.
Oh, no, I was specifically talking about writers. Like, I think there has been an existing path to break in for artists since the 60s, 70s, you know, for several generations. But for writers, there's, and I agree with you that is the fact that you can put out your own indie, and then if it gets, you know, gets attention, then the big two will snap
well,
you up
but
for
I also,
something.
I also think it's interesting, though, the whole thing right there with the looking for the big two, looking for writers. And even going back to Eve, who's going to be writing Ironheart, everybody's saying, like, oh, they're just getting anybody to write these things.
No.
Like, Ta-Nehisi Coates is award-winning, employed by The Atlantic. He's not losing anything. Roxane Gay. Like, how many amazing books and
awards? It also took
Ta-Nehisi
Coates, in my opinion, several issues to really learn how to write comics.
It did. Now, the learning curve is in terms of the medium, but not in terms of physically their writing. But Eve apparently is
Saladin Ahmed.
He's
I think this is his first year. I mean, he's been about a year. He's been writing comics.
Yeah,
he's been nominated for or won
incredible.
An Eisner.
Yeah,
did he win an Eisner for?
I don't know if he won for Abbott, but
no. The
Exiles.
No, the one with Black Bolt.
Oh, Black Bolt. Yes.
So
he did win for Black Bolt.
Yeah. So I mean, you're talking about he was a novelist and a poet, and they went so they do pluck people out, like Neil Gaiman had never written comics. I just wanted to say one other thing about the Kickstarter. The Gamergators are using Kickstarter.
Oh yeah.
They are now, now that they have been excluded to a certain degree. It took a long time where people, I think, were wondering why Ethan Van Sciver was still drawing Green Lantern and all that. And he probably had a contract with DC, and they didn't renew the contract. I'm just assuming. I don't know. But I also know that he's got these Kickstarters up that are in either the high five figures or low six figures. You were saying 10,000.
Yeah.
He's getting a lot more than that for his stuff. And I think that's the thing. I mean, yeah, it works for people on both sides. And I think that there was a time where they would have been sort of excluded from the industry. And now they're able to sort of do their own thing because Kickstarter.
But the thing is, to be honest, like, if they want to do that,
that's fine.
I don't, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, that's Kickstarter's business if they want to, you know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
yeah, sure. The interesting thing is Dave Sim, who's sort of the father of both independent comics with Cerberus, and whose attitudes you could argue are the father of
the comics
game.
Yeah,
he did, but he didn't start out that way. That happened during the run. He had
absolutely watch the change.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
It's one of the most amazing things. Somebody commented
on something, or that there was something.
He went from being like a normal human being to a raving lunatic while doing this, I mean, it is one of the most impressive feats in comics. Like,
I have to say,
he was a raving lunatic that was being a nice person, and then decided.
I will say this though, like, honestly, like, I think, I mean, like, first of all, I read those, and I don't regret it. And I would say that, like,
the
if
comics?
You, if you want to watch A Descent into Madness.
Yeah, it's quite literally.
It's kind of interesting to watch him completely lose his mind. I mean, like, I don't think he was ever really great about women, because I remember
the first.
Thing.
We're joking. We're saying, like, lose his mind or whatever, but does he have a mental disability? Is he, like, bipolar or something?
No, something happened where he had, I mean, and I'm not trying to be ableist, like, he had some kind of epiphany or breakdown.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it went from the point of view of sort of a satire of Conan and Red Sonja to, by the end, there are multiple issues where every page is a full page of Cerberus sitting in a chair screaming at the reader with, like, you know, balloons.
He's like
that
the
are
original,
like,
Alex Jones. Like, oh, you know?
Yes, quite literally, like really, really, really obscene anti-feminist views of, like, you know, women are a void that you can't fill. And men are energy,
so maybe,
and the phallic energy. I mean, just really crazy stuff.
Maybe the snap was, I don't know, a divorce or a girl left
him? Who knows? Or Thanos just came in.
You know, it is interesting. Both Steven Spielberg and George Lucas talk about how the sort of bad there's a real lot of bad vibes in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and they were both going through a divorce at the time.
Yeah.
And they both sort of blame it on that, which... You know,
the last thing I'll say about your comments about it kind of being over, I look at them like bullies. I don't think it's over. Just the adults showed up, yelled at them, so the bullies are now going to go back to yelling at, I don't know, people like me, black women. They're not going to stop. They're just going to not talk to the people that they thought were their heroes. I don't think it's broken up. I just think that they've been yelled at by teacher, principal. And the I don't know if they look at, I know that's how they look at Neil Gaiman, but I don't think that's how they look at Bill Sienkiewicz. I don't think they ever did. But the fact that other people that look like them are telling them that they're wrong is not going to stop them. I just don't think it is.
I actually agree with that.
I mean, I don't.
I would love to think that by Monday it's over.
No. Nobody ever goes away completely. I just think that, you know.
They took a hit, and I think that the fact that, again, that these major players came out and addressed them, it, rather than it being other people on Twitter or, you know, sort of people of – and it's people of a previous generation who have every possible award, every accolade, you know, and who could literally walk into either of the big two and say, I want to do this, and they would immediately be able to do that, you know.
Yeah. I think it has – an impact, right? It's the difference between, you know, having a, I don't know, Comicsgate was getting so big for a second that it was almost as if you had a leader of the free world who was openly in favor of white supremacy, let's just say, as a crazy hypothetical. And then all of a sudden it was like someone released an article to say, I don't know, the New York Times revealing that, like, in fact, nobody respected that guy, and that they're like, that entire movement was falling apart from the inside. Like, does it make everything better? No, absolutely it doesn't.
But it might be a hit.
But does it seem like maybe those folks are about to at least kind of crawl back under a rock and be quiet for at least a little bit, or at least a little less loud? Yeah, I think that.
Is that an improvement?
Yes, it is. Yeah, at least until somebody hears this podcast and then gets real mad. Anyway, boy, we talked about that for a long time. Hey, you want to talk about... let's talk about some horror movie stuff, because and horror in general, because I don't know if anybody else noticed this, but, like, man, it was like August, and, like, your local drugstore, like your local chemist, already started having, like, Halloween decorations. I was like, what's happening?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if this was like this outside of New York, but it definitely was true here.
Next week we'll see Christmas decorations.
It's wild. But, like, now that it's September, I accept. That the time for horror related things has begun, and that's okay.
Horror movies and pumpkin lattes are now here.
Last week, there's a bakery around the corner from me, and they're famous for all their, like, really super elaborate wedding cakes. And I walked by last week, and one day there were no cakes in the window. I was like, "Oh, what's going on?" You know,
everybody gets divorced in October.
No, what it was they were redoing their
display.
Watch
Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
A few days later, it was all Halloween cakes, and I was like, "Wow, this is quick. September 2nd."
First of all, why do you need a cake for Halloween?
And a wedding cake at that. They were all Halloween. All Halloween themed wedding cakes.
I'm sorry, it is called a hollow wedding.
Yes. Oh,
stop
nice.
It. Are you serious?
No, I don't know. I just made it up. I mean, I bet that's right. I mean, it sounds right. God. Anyway, all right. So, like, here are three horror-related things that occurred this week. The Nun came.
Speaking of Halloween.
Yeah. Yes. So the Nun came out. That's the I guess technically the third spin-off movie within the Conjuring universe. The Purge TV show dropped, and the first like true full Halloween trailer came out. Which one of those things was the best, Chico? Which one did you like the most?
You know, so much of this has to do with expectations. And so I'm going to say, actually, I thought that The Nun was the best. Part of it had to do with expectations. I happen to think the original Halloween is, you know, the greatest probably of the, you know, sort of slasher horror movies ever. I'm down on all the Friday the 13th after the first one. I don't like that they made Jason the villain, like it's supposed to be the mom and blah, blah, blah. But I wasn't waiting.
That's why I like the Sleepaway Camp movies.
They took off where
I stand behind. Those movies are terrible and I love them.
But so I wasn't, you know, either way. I kind of got excited when I saw the Halloween trailer. I actually got to see it in the theaters, not on my phone. But which is how I watch, I guess, a lot of trailers these days. But and The Purge, I actually liked The Purge movies. I wasn't expecting to like The Purge movies. I thought that the first Purge trailer looked like a lynching movie. Like there's a black man crying in a house and there's like white people outside demanding that he be brought outside.
Yikes.
And I was like horrified at the first Purge trailer. And I didn't see any of them in the theaters, but I watched them all on cable and I kind of liked them.
Yeah, I mean, like
Yes,
I mean, like, look, here's the thing. I also like the Purge stuff to a degree, and I would like it less if it had been like that sort of tortury Eli Roth or like Last House on the Left kind of, like, if it was like
that would have
been way too much for me, way too real. Like it has a veneer that I think for me at least is required.
Yeah, it works. Did you feel like it worked for the TV show? Did you see The Purge?
I saw the TV show. I did not see the first Purge because of that trailer.
Right.
I saw that trailer and I was like, and it was so funny because I'm trying to remember what movie. I saw the trailer in the movie theater. All I know is everybody in my row was like black or Latino and we all looked at each other like,
what is this?
What just happened?
Yeah.
And I remember saying, I don't have time to see this movie. It was like Rosewood to me. I'm like, I can't do this right now. But I have since seen scenes from it, and I have seen the first Purge, and I have seen the show. I was actually more confused as to where the show was going to end up, because I was like, okay, first Purge, we know what happened. Purge election year, that's supposed to be over, so where is this? So this is sort of, I guess, in between. What do you guys think? One and two, or two and three?
Yeah, I mean, like, I forget. They say at one point how many years The Purge has been going. I think it's been going for a little bit.
So it's like maybe between one and two.
At that point. I mean, like, it's. I think functionally, for the most part, it's meant to sort of exist on its own. So,
I mean, the show works in the way the movie does, but because it's TV, I actually felt like it, you know, it's on USA. I felt like it looked like some of these like Vancouver Canadian shows from like 7 years ago.
Yeah.
It didn't look like or feel like a new show in 2018. It felt like a new show in 2012 or 2013, which in the evolution of TV there has actually been. So it sort of looked like it felt like, and like, oh, look, I liked Continuum and Intelligence. And I mean, there were a couple other, those was a Lost Girl. You know, I kind of liked some of those shows a lot. But this looked and felt like that, and it was missing some of the cinematic sort of bigness that the movie, even though I saw them all on cable on my TV, like on the same TV that I watched the show on, I thought the show was missing a little bit of that.
It was very bright, whereas I that's all I can think of in terms of lighting and shooting it. But I guess because I know I did hear the director, because it's the same creator of the movies that's behind the show. And he was saying that he wanted to, the whole point of the show is to pull out these moments, like the movie is very much, you have a short period of time. And so you're hitting everybody with all of the, you know, the action. And he wanted to draw this out and kind of get behind into the lives of these people when they're not always purging.
It's like 24.
Yeah. Except you know that, yeah. I guess well, it that is was, like 24. The countdown,
I will say this.
This is what I wish.
Because I actually, like, I said, oh, I'm going to go to the set for the Purge TV show. And I didn't know anything about it because, you know, like, I'm lazy. No, I'm not lazy. I happened to not know anything about it until I knew I was going to go down. And I told a friend of mine, I said, oh, they're doing a Purge TV show. I'm going to go down to the set. And he goes, the hell would a Purge TV show be like? What is it, like 24, but the Purge? Oh, I just talked myself into it. I wish it was, and the thing is, I wish it would be that. Like, that is like, in an ideal setting, it's like
following one person?
It's like, it's 12 episodes, and every episode is 1 hour within the Purge. I would have been totally down for that. What it is, I've seen three episodes of it, and okay. I can't speak to the aesthetic, because what I have seen are like rough cuts, like they're sort of like a lock cut, so like there's a lot of stuff that still isn't,
yeah, it's
like
not color corrected,
right? So I can't speak to that, but it's basically like the first episode is like that. Right before the Purge, like basically ends like as the Purge is beginning, and then every episode after that is during the Purge, but like one character is kind of the focus, and so you get a little bit of what was happening with them before the Purge, like what led up and like their motivations. Yes, it's a little more like that.
I'm thinking the sister could not possibly have her own episode, because when that guy got off the bus in the first episode, he was kind of done, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm like, if she gets off that bus, it's over.
I mean, I will say that I think, so there's one character in particular that I find to be pretty interesting, because they do.
The couple?
The couples are interesting. I like Jane. So Jane is a character I think is interesting, because they do usually spend a lot of time where it's like white people being bad to like either black folks or like Latinx folks or whatever. Like this, her story is her boss.
Baldwin.
Yeah. It is a boss Baldwin keeps passing her over. And so she is hiring somebody on the Purge to go.
To take a hit out.
Go and take him out. And I was like, Okay.
I also got the feeling it was something else. I also got the feeling
that she's kind of conflicted about it. I think it is more complex than that, but like there's only one episode. There's like something in the episodes that I've seen where I was like, oh!
No, that's what I'm saying. I think there was more. I've only seen the first episode, but I really got the feeling that there was more than he's passing her over. I think there was something that happened with the two of them.
Well, time will tell. There's definitely some. There's one thing. I won't say what it is, but I was like, yikes. But I like that. And yeah, the couple stuff is interesting. There's like, again, because I've only, I'm like, what happened in which episode? I don't want to, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like and with that threesome thing, but then they're avoiding the girl that they, you only see that
Lily,
in flashbacks.
Lily Simmons is
Yeah.
She's related to the, basically.
A real pleasure in real life, by the way. Lily Simmons is a hoot.
Is she?
She's, yeah.
I was a huge fan of Banshee, which is a show that no one watched that I thought was like one of the best shows of its season. That's where I first saw her, and then she was in True Detective.
Because it's Banshee.
We got drunk and talked about Sex and the City. I asked when I was down in New Orleans, I said, who from Sex and the City would be best in The Purge? And every woman asked her like they had a doctoral thesis on the topic that they'd written, but like
they've clearly talked about
it. She was like really excited, and then we got drunk and just like goofed like the whole night, and it was great.
I mean,
she's great. I will say a great fantastic human being based on the
no one answered the Charlotte, weird lost I have weekend. To assume like there's no possible argument.
Oh,
for
my argument
for Charlotte.
Is Charlotte. That
oh
is my
God.
Answer.
Yeah,
Charlotte's
she should
the
be
worst.
Worst.
Charlotte's the best.
No, that she could survive the.
Oh, she
could
survive.
Absolutely,
oh, yeah.
The one. She's the no. Not only she can just survive. She's the one that's going to be out there in the streets killing.
You think?
Wow.
I couldn't disagree with the founding fathers trying to make sure that her dress doesn't look
bad. I got four words for you. Right. Still waters run deep.
Oh,
that's it.
Oh, boy.
That's my answer to you.
So you think she's got like a torture chamber in her basement?
Absolutely. No question in my mind. I have always, yes. Like, everybody, when I asked people this question, everybody said
you've got a much deeper view of her than
everybody,
I do.
Now I'm seeing Charlotte on
everybody
American
had
Horror
two
Story.
Answers. It was pretty much either Samantha or Miranda, just so we're all on the clear.
Right. I would assume that's what,
like, and I was like, if The Purge was all about, like, weird sex stuff, then yes, Samantha would be best at The Purge, but like the Purge is about murders. Like, let's just be real. The Purge is about murders, and Miranda, would she be good at it, or would Steve mess up and then she'd have to like go save him?
And then he'd cry.
And then, yeah, this is what I'm saying. So, like, I don't know, like, if Steve was just already dead, then, yeah, hell yeah, Miranda's dope. But if Steve's in the picture, I don't know about all that. Like, I feel like she's always got the ball and chain of Steve messing him up. Whereas Charlotte, you know what I mean? Like, she can't, like, she struggles in her life, married somebody with, like, things not always great. I feel like she's always trying to keep quiet. She's always, like, buttoned really tight. I feel like the Purge is the night where she goes and gets her revenge on the world.
I just feel like she doesn't have She doesn't have life skills, I feel like.
I don't know. Whenever, I think she's prepping in the dark.
Whenever a character in a TV show or a movie works in an art gallery, it's because they don't have life skills. It's like Marnie, so basically, wait, first things first, you should have asked which Golden Girl, because all Sex in the City is...
Be Arthur.
All
Be
Sex Arthur in the City is just this, like, it's Golden Girls, except it's set in New York, and they're like 10 years younger. Maybe 20 years younger.
No, I don't know if it's, but like...
But no, the characters are completely...
Just said B, but I don't even know if that's right.
No, the characters are completely the analogs. Like, Golden Girls is the original, like, thing that Sex and the City, Girls...
But everybody from Golden Girls is going to be good at that. Yeah. Everybody.
I don't know, because Rose, who's the Charlotte analog on would not do well in The Purge, I don't think. And I don't think Blanche would necessarily do well in The Purge. Be Arthur, definitely, and Sophia.
Sophia would kill everybody.
Sophia would be with double...
No, in fact, Sophia would kill Rose.
Right. But wait, here's my question. You mentioned something. It's like The Purge is about killing. That's something that bothers me about the franchise, because they make it very clear all crime is legal.
Oh, I agree completely.
And I don't think that most people would actually go out and kill.
No,
like, where
that's
are
the
Purge
thing.
Heists? Like, you're like, people are you know, like, all these businesses are just open to be robbed. Who's going to kill
not
someone when
that,
you can steal millions of dollars?
Not just that. All I can think of with those girls on the bus in the first episode when they're like, oh, we're giving ourselves, is like, someone's going to, just like that girl that was tied up in the room, that they're like, oh, we're inviting a bunch of people over later for the Purge and we're going to have fun with her. They are not just going to kill her. They're just going to torture her probably the entire day or night. So, like, that's the thing. Like, the whole premise has always kind of freaked me out a little bit, because for the same exact reason. It's like, okay, so we're out there to kill all these people when there's a perfectly good mansion over there?
Right.
Like, I don't understand.
So I just think there should be a little more.
There should be
more crimes being portrayed besides murder.
Clearly,
people are going to run out and kill people if they don't. You know, I mean, there's
Where
no doubt.
Is, like, are there. I mean, like, I've never looked it up, so I guess I don't know the answer. But, like, there should be a ton of weird XXX porn parodies for The Purge, shouldn't there?
There definitely should be. I agree.
There has to be. Like, because,
how do we
because,
get
like,
to porn
but,
purge?
Like,
how?
Like,
how
is there are for every comic
all bets
book
are
movie.
Off. Just think of all of the weird sex shit people,
even the Marvel
people
shows.
Do publicly.
There's a Daredevil Elektra.
So there has to be. But that's
actually, the Marvel porn stuff is pretty funny because they've actually got really, really, really good cinematography. I'm like, somebody explain to me how they have a better camera. And how come Superman's beard looks better here than he does in a real movie?
In the Batman Bane one, the Bane porn actor doesn't speak at all, which is absurd, because the one thing that you identify with Bane is actually the voice. And I know someone who actually dubbed in Bane dialogue from the Batman movie into the actual scenes.
Did it make it better than The Dark Knight Rises?
Yes, it's actually amazing. Like, you know.
I'm sorry. So Bane Batman porn is where we are now.
Yes.
I'm just checking.
Yes.
Because I made a left turn at Porn Purge, and I think I turned around.
Well,
you made a wrong turn at Albuquerque.
I was just defending the idea that there could be Purge.
It is weird to me. Like, I would say, like, for 12 hours, there's no laws. I don't think most people are going to the murder place.
Right.
But I do think that a lot of people are weird perverts and want to be weird perverts in public. And so that I do think would happen.
Absolutely.
For sure. That's what I'm saying. I think if The Purge were real, that's what you would be seeing. You would see Pervert Purge. That's what it would be. Anyway, that's like a whole other
perverts, arson, you know, I think a lot of, you know, robbery, you know.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. Like, that's it. People would do a lot of drugs on the streets. Like I don't know, just basic stuff. Why does it have to go right to murder? It's like, why is everybody so extra in the Purge world?
Well, because that's the thing, because it's a culling. That's what the founding fathers are trying to turn it into, is a culling. And I think the only other thing that freaks me out about the Purge is this. In the state of the world that we live in now, having this whole founding fathers storyline and people there's some people out there whose connection or connection to reality is not as strong as ours.
Right.
I have an issue. That's the only thing I have an issue with. But I will push through because so many people did say that the first Purge did end up really good. Although I don't understand how it had a wonderful ending when clearly it's a prequel and everybody, there's two other Purges with thousands and millions of people die. So I don't know. But that's my take on the Purge.
All right. Yeah. I think the show, like, it got really mixed reviews, but like the stuff that I've seen, I'm enjoying it. I will say that.
I have a question about the Nun.
We can talk about the Nun.
You went to Mexico.
I went to Mexico.
I asked and the them, premiere like, was in Mexico?
Would Charlotte survive?
A pretty Catholic country, if people don't know.
Yes, it is a very Catholic place to be.
Yeah, like to, you know.
So what is, because
yeah, it's,
I,
it's
you
basically
said it's,
Catholicism and siestas, like that's, you know.
You said Catholicism and siestas. So I did not see this movie. So is it a prequel to The Conjuring? Because we're talking about a lot of prequels.
Yes, it is. It's set in the 1950s. It is a 1950s era film. It's supposed to, my understanding was
that. Badly behaving nuns?
No, sadly no.
Nuns Behaving Badly is not what the movie is about.
Nor are they nuns on the run.
But the director, Corin Hardy, like, I think he wanted to do something that was sort of Mario Bava-esque. I think what he wound up with, and what I keep saying, is that, like, it's got a little bit of Hammer horror to it, and somewhere in the third act, he starts pulling out some Sam Raimi nonsense. There's a moment where, and I don't want to spoil it, something happens, and I was like, oh, okay. So now it's going to get a little bit bananas. And it definitely, like, I mean, this is pretty, like, typical. Like, I mean, I feel like the James Wan stuff since Insidious, the third act is always, you know what I mean? It's like the first two acts are one kind of movie, and then the third act is a completely different kind of movie, and The Nun has got that.
So, yeah, I actually completely agree. To me, I got like sort of weird historical Hammer stuff.
Yeah.
And like combined with like Warren Ellis's take on Castlevania.
Yeah, yeah.
That was very much what I got. Although I think you are 100% on point with the Sam Raimi. My only disagreement, I would say some of the Sam Raimi stuff starts even earlier than the third act.
Yeah.
And again,
well,
there's
a character I would say that
okay,
is.
Yeah, yeah.
I will say there's a character named Frenchie.
Yes.
Frenchie is the Raimi-esque character for sure. Anything involving him has got that, and the more he's in it, the more, and the further the movie you get into, I think the more Raimi-esque.
And some of that stuff took me out of it a little, took but me out of the movie a
here's
little a, bit.
Here's an interesting fact about that, though. There'll be an article where I'll talk about this a little more, I think, at the beginning of next week. But that was not the original intention, and that was not the first cut of the film. When they did the first cut of the film, when they were showing it to people, the character of Frenchie tested really well, so they put a lot more of him in there. And the way things sort of go for him and like where the movie ends for him is different in the final cut than what was originally intended.
That's interesting.
So, yeah, like,
did they not intend the actual, like what, like, because he's a prequel. He is a character that we see. I mean, was that was in there from the beginning?
Yes. But okay. We can talk. I mean, like, we can talk about the spoilers for it at some point. Like when we're in, like, we'll talk about that. But like, I want to talk about like sort of the general stuff for just a few.
No. Yeah.
I mean, like, it is. It's yes. I mean, like, to a degree, yes. But he gets more screen time because people liked him,
right?
And that was that. And also, that actor was supposed to be involved in the Crow movie that Corin was trying to make happen.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if he was going to be playing the Crow, but right. Like, yeah, they had like those two were like thick as thieves. Like, so yeah, like this is kind of like this stuff that was happening in the background with that actor and Corin and as a result, Frenchie as a character.
Yeah, I think that the Conjuring franchise in general is a step above a lot of the other stuff. I'm not a huge Insidious fan personally, but I think The Conjuring, there's the historical element that adds something. I think the cast is really good. And I feel like they really did a great job. I didn't actually see Annabelle. So I thought they did a really good job with the nun sort of bringing that sort of class, that elegance, even though there is some sort of weird Sam Raimi stuff that is the opposite of elegant. There's just some something that the nun and the Conjuring and maybe Annabelle have that just sort of sets it above a lot of the
second
modern...
Annabelle. The second Annabelle has got some stuff. The first one is a little... Anyway, I mean, it's interesting that you say that because I find... in the horror community, and you may have had a different experience, that the James Wan stuff is like that mainstream stuff that like real horror hounds hate, get like real mad, like that's not the real thing, like that's the people that don't really understand the genre, like, and that drives me up a wall.
Yeah,
like I don't like, it's like, you know, it's a big ass world. How many horror movies come out every year? A lot. You know, like, it's funny, people be like, man, horror is really having a renaissance. And I'm like,
it's always had a renaissance.
It's a permaissance. What are you talking about? Like, I have never, like, I watch, I think, a minimum of 20 new horror movies a year.
Yeah.
Brand new, never, like, you know, and they're not all great, but, like, they'll tell you a genre of film of which there is a glut of every subgenre possible coming out all the time. It's horror. Like, so I don't think that the Nun or the Conjuring universe in general is somehow like harmful or antithetical. It's like really weird to me that people will get that way. Like, I saw the Nun and I was like, it was exactly what, like, I mean, like, I don't have huge expectations for the movies either. Like, that's the thing. I'm like, is it going to be a roller coaster ride? Is it going to have some good visuals? Like, that's the thing. Like, James Wan, he knows how to make a movie look real nice. Like, his movies look real good. Mm-hmm. And he was involved in this, and Corin Hardy is also a really talented filmmaker. And so between the two of them and the DP on the film, like, it's a great-looking movie. I will say one thing about it, though. I kind of wish that it was in black and white.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Well, then that would have had a whole other sort of feel to it because it took place in this, you know, it would have felt like the 1930s, like, Universal movies. Instead of that, like, Hammer, Mario Bava feel.
Yeah, I kind of had a moment where, like, some of the Nun stuff, like, the Nun herself.
Yeah, she looked like Marilyn Manson,
yes.
like the more you actually saw her.
Yeah.
I was gonna respond to something that you just said, and now I've blanked. sorry.
I was gonna say was it just went past me that James Wan is also the same director of Aquaman. So it's like two completely different genres than I wouldn't think, you know.
One thing I wanted to, that I realized what I was going to say, you mentioned it takes place in the 1950s, but it really could, evoking that Hammer Mario Bava, like, it feels like it could be in the 1550s or the 1650s.
Oh, yeah. Well, they do that by going to, like, a part of, like, Europe where it's land that time forgot kind
exactly.
of thing.
I mean, it's like, and I'm not sure if, like, in the 50s, like, people would have been traveling by horse and cart. So I actually thought it was the 30s, and it was only when there was a radio.
They make a point of it at one point.
There's a radio song. When they talk about the war.
But they talk about, they even talk about the buggy. There is a moment where, like, the guy's like, oh, yeah, we still use horses here, and they act like it's weird.
But I couldn't tell this. So they mentioned that basically part of the plot is that the bombs from World War II have awakened. So they just said the bombs from the war. So I initially thought they meant World War One. Exactly. And I was like, oh, it's the 30s. But regardless, it doesn't matter because it has a very timeless. Backwater part of Romania hasn't, you know, come into the 20th century yet, essentially, and certainly this convent hasn't either.
Yeah, I don't know, man. It's funny. I watched it. I mean, maybe it was because I saw it in an abandoned convent.
Right.
And I was surrounded by people that wanted me to like it.
But I really
liked this movie.
Yeah, I did too.
I had no expectations going in.
And that's, I think the expectations, I didn't either. And I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, we were thinking about this the whole time when I was down in Mexico. Every person I talked to, they were like, man, they are spending so much money promoting this thing. But I know that an article actually came out on sci-fi.com, and I assume probably across any nerd website, that, like, this thing has made more money in pre-sales than, like, every other Conjuring movie combined.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah, like this thing is like is peaked. It's ready to make a lot of money, which I'm shocked by. Like The Nun.
There were about eight people in the theater in a 10 o'clock Thursday night. So I walked out being like, oh, I guess no one's going to see this.
No, apparently it had a lot of presale. So I guess we'll see. I mean, like it's sort of hard to say. Like it's still a horror movie. So like, right. By what metric are we talking? Like, you know, at what point is it? I don't know how much money they spent on this, to be honest, on the pre-pro, and I don't know how much they spent on marketing, other than to assume a lot. But yeah, I mean, like, I do think it's going to be pretty successful. I think that the pre-sales are there, and horror movies and critics,
right?
Not really important, to be honest. Like, they never are. You know, like
really.
No,
because
I mean,
it's
like
such an acquired or a
personal
thing.
I think that it's very, because like horror, like the
they
things
look down,
that scare
it's,
you.
It's genre stuff that looks down on. I mean, very. There's a couple of times like Rosemary's Baby or The Exorcist.
Yeah, and it's always, and that's the other thing. What's funny is that like the movies that they sometimes will make a big old deal of, like they'll be like, ah, It Follows is the greatest horror
right.
movie
yeah,
ever
exactly.
made, and I'll
right.
be like, I liked It Follows,
right.
but I've already seen Halloween, and it right. literally rips off shots from Halloween. So
absolutely, and the world. I was going to say, you're right. We don't see any adults in Halloween. The fact that we don't really see any adults in It Follows.
There are a lot of parallels, and they're intentional.
Yeah.
You know, but like, but they do that, and they did that with Hereditary. They're like Hereditary, and I, like all these critics, people who like love horror movies, are like. Hereditary is the greatest horror movie of the last 20 years. And I was like, did we all see the same third act? Okay.
It's that's why Get Out couldn't get a Best Picture nomination because
oh, yeah.
it was a horror movie.
Yeah.
Critics just don't.
There's just, yeah, exactly.
And that's why they thought it was a musical.
I think in general, yes. horror movies are so to taste
yeah.
that people don't really pay attention to critics. I think that people will go like, well, yeah, but like, I don't know. I just want a quick roller coaster ride or whatever it is that they want. They want to get a little quick scare and something that'll make them like giggle nervously and that looks all right. Like, honestly, like that's the thing about these movies, like these types of mainstream horror movies is they could do pretty well mostly on word of mouth. Like critics are, I think, largely irrelevant when it comes to this particular specific type of horror movie, especially.
Yeah, no. And this has a built-in audience because of, you know, it's part of a franchise.
Yeah.
And it's a franchise that I think has held up in the sense
yeah.
of,
I like
know,
Conjuring. I like Conjuring 2. Annabelle is not great, but Annabelle 2 Creation is genuinely – you know what? It's like the first Ouija was terrible and then the second Ouija was pretty solid. It's the same thing.
Yeah, I would also argue that another reason why critics don't like there's a glut of like there like it is true that like most yeah there are great horror movies but there are also a lot of lousy horror movies and I think that and a lot of them are low budget
mm-hmm.
and I think also critics don't get it. They're turned off by the gore, the blood. You know, I think that there were critics who got that the original Dawn of the Dead set in the mall is about consumerism and 80s Reagan, you know, the direction that America was going in and stuff like that. But I think a lot of people just saw like zombies in a shopping mall, you know. There's a lot of horror
yeah.
that
which,
there's multiple
yes,
levels.
Yeah. Dawn of the Dead is like
people, yeah,
like that's it. It literally is like the news saying like, here's what's going on, but
yeah.
it's mass hysteria. They're not providing any facts, and the thing that's supposed to be a fact, which is a little ticker at the bottom, their bottom third revealing where the safe spaces are no longer safe spaces. But if you turn them off, people will be like, well, if you turn that off, then no one will watch. So even though it's not actually true that it's safe to go there, leave it up there anyway. Like, this is the 1970s, and it's like, wow, they had the 24-hour news cycle down way before. You know what I mean? It's like
absolutely.
Between that and Network, they're like two of
yeah.
like the most important movies about the miserable future now present of the state of modern news.
And he actually, Romero sort of does that, taking, you know, include, well, Land of the Dead, which Sci-Fi Wire actually has an article up this week.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. It does a really good job with that as well, you know, and I think that, you know, he uses the horror, as do a lot of other directors, to demonstrate or to show various sort of social
But it's not always it's not always immediately evident or like it's weird that like I think a lot of critics just never
there's prejudice against it. I mean, in the sense of it's a horror movie, it can't be like a good movie.
And I think the criticism at the time, even for Dawn of the Dead, was that it was like, oh, a little on the nose. It's never going to be like this. And it's like, literally, I mean, like, what, really?
Right.
Because, like, wasn't the whole, like, cause it's like, so first it's the newsroom, then it's like, they're in, like, a tenement building where, like, of course, like, this
the
is
the cops
where
are going through
the
and
cops
they're
are
shooting,
going
like,
through
yeah, exactly.
And killing anybody that isn't white.
Right.
And, like,
whether they're a zombie or not.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, and it's also this idea that, like, this is where an illness is spreading there, and so they're killing indiscriminately and certainly not looking to see if there's a cure.
Right.
And then all of a sudden it's late-stage capitalism, and that's, like, the whole rest of the movie is late-stage capitalism.
Absolutely.
It's brilliant.
It's
I would say I think it's in my top five favorite movies ever made, to be honest. But, like, but yeah, anyway, The Nun is not that, but The Nun is very entertaining.
Yeah.
I would highly recommend it. If you want to go and have a fun time, it's got a cool slow burn. There's some cool stuff in a graveyard. I think all of the actors are really game. I think it's really well shot. I definitely think that you can see like Corin Hardy has not done a ton of stuff, but like, man, I think the man has got a future for sure. And you can really tell that James Wan was involved. You can tell that he was
he was really in it.
So yeah, I mean, like, I would highly recommend it. As for Halloween, boy, this really is going to be a long podcast.
I saw the trailer for Halloween in the theaters before I saw The Nun, and again, I was like, whatever, but I was actually pretty psyched, you know, after the trailer. I was like, oh yeah, this looks good. I mean, it's been 40 years.
It has been, but here's what I like about it. I like that everything's gone now. All the rest of the movies. I mean, like, I like elements of some other Halloween movies, but, like, did we really need... we don't even need to even count 2. 2 is boring. Can we be honest? Halloween 2 is a very boring movie.
I think I've just seen 2 once, and I don't really... It's
really forgettable. And then after that, it's like it's just, like, off the wall.
Right.
And so I think it's fine, and I think that the reason why it's cool to have just the original Halloween and now this as the only now sequel in this particular version of the timeline is that the first movie is ultimately about a young person or young people in general, but like Laurie Strode sort of being like our main centerpiece, like sort of our understanding of I was young, I had a sense of immortality, and then I reached an age in which I realized that death is inevitable. And it took the form of this shape who is Michael Myers, right? So that whole movie is trying to run away from the inescapable. And even when you think for this one moment you have managed to survive, you know that it's not really gone, that it will always return. That's the first movie. And now this trailer that came out to me says this is now about when you're at the end of your life and you are now chasing death. You're like after it. You're like, well, if I'm going to go out, then like I'm going out in a blaze of glory. Like I'm going to give a fight. Like I have a lifetime full of regrets and I want to make sure that I get to deal with whatever my biggest one is before I go. And for Laurie Strode, it's that she wasn't able to take out this guy and she needs it because her life, she knows her number is up. So she's going to get him before, like, they, like if they've got to go out together, then so be it. And I just think that's a perfect companion.
Yeah, I would argue that's absolutely, again, like, totally on point. Like, it's sort of like Linda Hamilton's arc from Terminator 2.
Yeah.
Like, in Terminator 2, she's the Terminator.
Yes.
I mean, Arnold Schwarzenegger's running around saying hasta la vista, baby, and shooting cops in the knee and everything to get its PG-13 rating. But she's the hardcore Terminator, and in the first one she's scrappy and stuff, but she's still a meek, you know.
But the whole scene where she goes to Dyson's house,
that's the best
scene in the whole movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you know, the same thing with this, like to see Jamie Lee Curtis, Laurie Strode is now like proactive and yeah, it's a badass to see like you know, which 60 something year old woman hunting Michael Myers.
I loved Jamie Lee Curtis is just a wonder. I mean, she's I think probably one of my favorite most charismatic performers of the last 50 years, you know what I mean? Like, and it's cool. It's exciting to see Halloween get all of this press, and it's already getting a lot of praise based on these trailers.
David Gordon Green is really talented.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
and he's kind of been all over the place genre-wise, but he is visually a really unbelievably talented director. If you go back to his indie stuff, you know, All the Real Girls and... the one about the there's one about the kids is it what Washington he's before he hooked up with doing like the comedy stuff on HBO he was doing these like very visual art movies that were, you know, sort of the narrative took a backseat to the visuals.
Well, and the thing is that this, I mean, this movie feels very Carpenter-esque.
Like, yeah,
just based on the trailer,
yeah.
At least. You know, the way they've cut that trailer, you're like, yeah, this to me feels like a classic 70s era Carpenter flick. And when the music starts
in the trailer, you're like, I mean, like, there was definitely a... you know, you could feel it in the eight people in the audience. So suddenly, you know.
No, but I mean, I saw the trailer, and you guys know how I feel about horror. But it's really funny that you did say that it harkens back to the original thing in the 70s, because I really felt the same thing that I've seen with any Halloween trailer. It's like, why? Like, just there's certain things. Like, if I'm just looking at the trailer, not the movie, which I probably won't watch because horror. There's just things that happen that just don't make any sense to me, which is why I like thrillers better. Because, like even the trailer that just dropped, when he's, like, walking down the street, first of all, where are the adults? There's no adults with the children. This dude is just walking around. Why is the back of your house open? Like, the horror tropes, for me, this is why I just can't get into it. It's like, why? If all of these people, like, actually live, like, I don't know, like we do in New York, this wouldn't happen.
One of the weird things about the original Halloween is that there's no one really trick or treat. Like, there's no one out. You know what I mean? Like, it's the streets are empty and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
And that was the one thing that I felt was different about the trailer, is that there were like hundreds of kids trick or treating.
Yeah, that's not real. You know, I guess Haddonfield is just a very different place.
Right, exactly.
Clearly. You leave your doors open and.
Yeah, but even that sort of commentary on the suburbs, like sort of like a Blue Velvet, you know, thing that, you know, in every suburb there's a Michael Myers, you know, waiting to come in through your open back door.
I grew up in the suburbs. No, yeah. The back door was not open.
Right.
But anyways, that's my little 2 cents on the trailer. Because, you know, I'm not going to see this movie.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, you know, I'm mad because I ain't going on a Fantastic Fest, and that's where it's premiering. I mean, bless all of y'all that are going to see it. Because, yeah, I'm very excited. Anyway, gosh, we had so many things we were going to talk about, but we've been talking for, like, I think at least an hour and 20 minutes already.
But it's been fun.
I know.
Thank you, Chico.
Sure, yeah, no. Yeah, I've,
I
mean, I've
like,
never been
thank you for coming to talk horror with Danny, because I wasn't going to be able to do it.
I've
do
never
you
wanna,
been
do you want
to say thumbs up or thumbs down on Iron Fist and Captain Marvel so far, just very quickly? Because that was the other thing that happened.
Well, the only thing, I don't think we have, there's no fingers that have been grown yet for the Captain Marvel, because we've really only seen the Entertainment Weekly stuff at this point.
Yeah,
can
we all acknowledge that it was ridiculous for Brie Larson and EW to be like, we're going to break the internet, and then like you're like, okay, if there's a really dope-ass trailer, then
right.
Sure,
no.
But all it was is just like a bunch of pictures, and it's like, and then also they were like, well, I mean, she's going to be a flawed hero. I was like, a flawed hero in Marvel? This is brand new.
Well,
Tony Stark, Doctor Strange, literally every single other one.
Okay, she's going to be a flawed hero. I mean, here's the thing. The only thing that I would say is my theory of when everybody was yelling about seeing the set pictures and she was in a green suit, the green suit was clearly Kree. So she's clearly starts with the Kree. That was, you know, shown. I was not that crazy about the cover shot.
She's on Trump's Space Force, and then, you know. Yeah,
the cover shot was weird to me because I felt they did so much photoshopping of it. Her head did not look like it was on her body. But the suit looks nice. And then everything else, I have feelings about the fact that it's Maria Rambeau with the call sign Photon. I know that there's supposed to be a Monica in the movie, which means Monica must be a child, which means her mama gonna die. I have a problem with that, but that's just me. And then
you're not gonna be alone, that I'm sure.
And then the other issue, the only other thing I had, which was not like a criticism, I just thought it was really funny, but like the Skrulls in that like R&B album promo shot.
Oh yeah,
and
all looking like James Marsters' Piccolo from the Dragon Ball movie.
I was like, I don't understand, but I'll buy this album. So I don't want to judge it on this Entertainment Weekly thing. I have learned that we really do need to see the trailer than the movie.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing is also you haven't mentioned Jude Law is in it.
Yes.
And any movie that
and he's Mar-Vell.
But they haven't actually officially said that, have they? I don't think they've actually said the words he's Mar-Vell.
I'm almost
they've suggested it. They've suggested it very heavily, but I don't know if they've actually said the words.
No, okay. I like Jude Law, but I'm about to say these words.
Uh-oh.
Jude Law has not been in a movie that has not underperformed financially very seriously. I mean,
uh-oh,
there was one year where he starred in six movies and all of them bombed.
Was one of like, them AI?
What?
Was one of them AI?
No, AI.
Was it the AI year?
Yeah, no. It was the Jude Law year, but it was like after that. It was the year of like Sky Captain, The World and Tomorrow,
oh,
Alfie.
Gosh.
Like he literally every 2 or 3 months there was a Jude Law movie came out and all of them bombed.
Yeah, you are not Dwayne The Rock Johnson,
yeah,
sir.
No, he is not. I mean,
even Dwayne The Rock Johnson wasn't Dwayne The Rock Johnson
yet. So I actually do like Jude Law, but it's very weird. He's like Sharon Stone. Like if he's in your movie, it's gonna bomb.
Yes. Just to clarify, IMDb lists Jude Law as Walter Lawson / Mar-Vell. So
okay,
he is actually Mar-Vell.
Okay.
That is because I was like, that would be really weird if he wasn't.
So I actually, as someone who was reading the Avengers as a kid actively on the newsstand when, you know, during the Monica Rambeau years, like I never in a million years would have ever thought that I would have seen her character in a movie.
Yeah.
So I'm really totally psyched about that. I'm very impressed with how Marvel is bringing on their sort of next generation of characters, you know, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Black Panther, and Shuri. I actually think Shuri is more important for the future of the Marvel Universe
than
Black
now.
Panther.
She is now, because he got caught up in the Snapchat.
Whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
I think she literally is going to be just like in the comics, the next Black Panther in the movie. But anyway.
And Captain Marvel, like, I think just in terms of they're really doing a great job moving all that along, like, with setting all that up. But, you have to discuss, I mean, with Ronan the Accuser and all this, I mean, their main cosmic franchise is totally has an issue right now.
Yeah, huge.
And I just want to say, I'm not even going to get into whether I, you know, agree or disagree. Like, the people out there being like, oh, why doesn't Taika Waititi take it? Or what? Like, any director is not going to take that movie. Like, that movie is, like, cursed. It would be like a scab crossing a line. Like,
oh, yeah, someone asked Paul Feig if he would take it.
Yeah.
And he was like, no!
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I think that's a major issue that no, like, I was really shocked at people being like, whoa, well, this is great. This will be an opportunity for this person or this person. I'm like, no one wants to be in that position. So I think it's really unfortunate because I can't believe how successful they were at introducing all this crazy cosmic stuff, including even a little bit some of the stuff on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but really with the Guardians of the Galaxy universe and how they incorporated it so well into Infinity War and just all of it. And it's really unfortunate because I don't know how that's going to affect Captain Marvel or the sort of Marvel universe going forward. But
yeah,
they have hit their first snag. And it is, you know, due to people who are at least spiritually related to Comicsgate and Gamergate, you know.
Yep. Sure is.
Yeah,
sure is,
so,
to bring it all the way back.
Exactly.
I think these things do relate.
But I'm psyched. I mean, I totally agree with you that you don't say you're going to break the internet and release 3 photographs or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm going to give Brie Larson the benefit of the doubt and say that she didn't know what they were going to.
Or they told, yeah, or they told her, like, she, you know, she signed a contract and
right,
they said, you will say this on this date.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
the
contracts is clad in iron.
I mean, a few years
Iron
ago
Man.
Was.
And the Marvel snipers are real.
Yeah.
A few years ago was like, I couldn't believe this, you know, people are breaking down every trailer shot by shot. Like, to a certain degree, I do think this advance, like, whatever, sucks the energy and life force out of some of these movies. But now it's gotten to the point where it's like, there's multiple trailers and everyone discusses all the multiple trailers. And now it's like that we're discussing, I'm not criticizing, you know, but that we're discussing.
I was gonna
these,
say, you are
these,
talking about basically what we're doing.
The
right
four
now.
Pictures. Well, but no, we spent a lot of time talking about the movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
But you're right. This picking a part of the trailer, which can be edited to be anything,
right,
versus looking at the movie and getting the actual.
But we're not even talking about the trailer now. We're just talking about some
pictures,
on-set photos, you know? And so I do worry that you know, like, creates this, you know, like, you get to the movie and it's like, well, I've seen this, I've seen that, I've seen, you know.
I just don't think we're going to see even a teaser until at least, I mean, I would love to see one at New York Comic Con, but I would find that really strange. I'm thinking Christmas we might see a teaser.
I don't even know.
Is Captain Marvel the next Marvel movie to come out?
In the theaters, yeah, yes.
I think so. Pretty sure.
Yeah.
Pretty sure it's next.
I'm almost positive.
Don't think we got anything else. Anyway.
Probably in the next event, Infinity War 2 or whatever it's going to be called.
But it's Captain Marvel first.
Yeah.
Captain Marvel's first and then. Anyway, very quickly, I guess good news? Iron Fist season 2, just to say it lightning fast.
The shortest thing that I will say is that Raven Metzner, who's the new showrunner and took over for Scott Buck of Inhumans fame, I think he's done a better job. I think it's more of an ensemble feel. I mean, look, they brought Danny Rand into Luke Cage season 2 and I didn't hate him, and I told Chayo Hadari Coker to his face, I don't know how you did that. But
rehabilitation started of the character started in Defenders.
Well, other people have said that too.
Yeah.
And so his character's taken an arc. I think that because it's in New York, we're not in Kunlun, we're not running around, although there's flashbacks and stuff, I do feel like all the other characters, Davos and Colleen, and there is some a little Daughters of the Dragon that we're getting. And they just need to do that show, Daughters of the Dragon.
Oh, without a doubt.
But I feel like, and Alice Eve as Typhoid Definitely Mary is actually really good with her alters and things like that.
Yeah, I think she just like bleeds right into that role. Like I said, I didn't even recognize her when I started the first time in the show.
Yeah, I mean, I would be curious to hear what you guys think in like the comments and on Twitter and stuff. Like when you watch it this weekend or whatever, what you think.
Yeah, and my impression
this
is
this isn't going to break Netflix.
If you were waiting for a series where like you loved the character of Iron Fist, you're not going to get that. I don't know if that day is ever going to come.
Well, I mean, the first season of Iron Fist I thought was completely saved by Colleen Wing.
Yeah.
And I cannot believe, it's shocking to me, that no one has done a supercut that's just the scenes with her.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Danny's in a lot of those scenes, but like that's the show that I'm really shocked that no one has done that. And I actually think as bad as season one of Iron Fist was, I actually think she saved it and made it actually, the first season of Iron Fist is actually better than the second season of Jessica Jones.
I agree.
Oh, yeah. I'm actually going to say that
Jessica Jones season 2 is the worst Marvel Netflix thing that has come out.
What were they thinking? Because season 1, you won a Peabody and like,
I have already, gosh, I have talked a lot about that topic, but the short version is, we agree.
Yeah.
But,
and if you're looking to see a little steel serpent from Davos, you do get some of that this season.
Yeah, I mean like, yes. Anyway, absolutely. I think they leaned into the fact that this is not a perfect character. He's going through a trial because he's not perfect. You're getting even more Colleen stuff, which I think is great. I think they kind of lean into the fact that they don't have a perfect relationship. They don't have great chemistry. Like, they've actually, I think they have kind of weaved that into the story.
That's why I like the showrunner. He's looked at all of the things that are like, these are the weaknesses, but we're going to acknowledge them in the story, which I think makes it work better. Is it perfect? No.
A huge improvement.
Apparently Finn Jones did train this time, and there's also the stunt doubles that are actually more his size. So there's a lot of really, really good close hand-to-hand combat for those of you guys out there that are like really good big fight scene people.
Well, the Netflix Marvel shows have done that.
They didn't do it with Iron Fist season 1.
No, but they've done, I thought Daredevil elevated the fighting on, you know.
That
on,
whole
on,
old on, boy hallway scene.
There was a lot of really great stuff in there.
Yeah. Anyway, I do think, like, for me, as a person that couldn't even make it through the whole first season of Iron Fist.
Oh, it was a slog.
And it's nice because it's only 10 episodes, which I think is good. I still wish that the episodes were, like, 43 minutes instead of 53 minutes, but, you know, it is what it is. But, yeah, I'm actually going to sit and watch the whole thing.
Well, this one also isn't going to be, like, you know, like 90% people sitting in an office building. I mean,
yeah,
the first season
goodness.
Was just the Rand or, you know, Rand Corporation shenanigans of just that family, the Meachums.
Yeah.
Just a Meacham, more Meachums, Meachums.
Nice
Meachums.
To meet him.
Yeah. That's all the, I mean, So,
no, it's much better. And the brother and sister team, the way that they're presented in this season, again, is far more palatable, far more interesting. And I do think that, like, Alice Eve, so far of what I've seen of her Typhoid Mary performance, yeah, I'm into it. I think she's more interesting than Davos, personally. But yeah. But we'll see how it goes. Anyway, all right, we talked for like an hour and a half, I think, which is like out of control. Adam's going to be furious, but that's okay.
That's what he gets for not being here, huh?
That's what happens. That's what happens. He definitely would have said 20 times, and like, wrap it up. Anyway, it didn't happen, but I think the conversation was real good. Thank you for listening. If you are not subscribed to Who on the Week, the podcast, please do subscribe and give us a review. Because I listen to reviews. I can't speak for anybody else, but I definitely do. And make sure that you're also checking out all the other podcasts in the Sci-Fi Wire family, Strong Female Characters, Fandom Files, Official Winona Earp Podcast, all the podcasts that are on our Amazon Alexa skill right now. If you would, you don't have to, but I would appreciate it. And before we go, can you, my two lovely guests, reveal where it is that people can find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me, Karama, the Blurred Girl, TageBlerdGurl, all over Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. But yeah, I'll know I get mail on Twitter. I stay there.
Yeah, you can find me at The Chico Leo, one word, TheChicoLeo. on Twitter, and I'm pretty much just on Twitter.
You're not on Instagram yet?
I have an Instagram account, but I quite literally never ever use it. I'm on Twitter all the time, though.
We are going to drag you out of the old. Right. We're going to do this.
That's right. I like that. Twitter is the old.
I just have cat pictures on my Instagram, though.
Right. Okay.
That's one way to use it.
Yes, sure. I have a cat.
So there you go. That's a great way to start.
But where is that Instagram?
What an excellent question. My name is Danny Roth. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Danny Ordinary. That is Danny with one N. Ordinary, also with one N. This has been Who Won the Week. Thank you for winning our week, and we'll see you again next week.